This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 151 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Well, Max, we had a great week last week. It was really good seeing you and being in person and spending a couple of hours together and not looking through a television monitor.
It was great face-to-face. Of course, we were at the National Air and Space Museum's Innovations in Flight Day. And we had the rest of the Airplane Geeks crew, many listeners of this podcast and also of Airplane Geeks, and of course, many others. So it was a really fantastic day of aviation.
We will be doing that again, but, you know, we were going to do some interviews and we have an interview with Princess Aliyah Pandolfi from the Kashmir Foundation, but we're going to put that on hold because the thing we've been waiting for 2 years, 3 years, is finally out. 107 is out.
That's right. The FAA has released the rule that finalizes the NPRM that came out in February 2015. That's the one, of course, titled Operation and Certification of Small Unmanned Aircraft Systems. The NPRM, it proposed operating and certification requirements for small UAS for non-hobby and non-recreational purposes. You can read that as commercial. And of course, as we all know, to this point, commercial operations had involved the world of Section 333 exemptions and COAs and special airworthiness certificates and all that. But now this new rule will take over and will add a new Part 107 to Title 14 of the Code of Federal Regulations. So we're very close, David, to being able to begin more widespread commercial use of UAVs.
You know, I guess we can stop the podcast now because this is what we've been waiting for all these years.
Well, this is where it starts to get fun, though, I think, because, you know, now we'll start to see maybe a blossoming of activities using unmanned aircraft. It kind of feels like the tip of the iceberg is just visible now.
Oh, I was going to say the light at the end of the tunnel, but okay.
That works too.
Folks, choose your analogy for whatever you want to use. So I guess we should get into it. It's been a flurry. All of our friends, associates have been talking about it. So let's talk about operational limitations of Part 107 and 55-pound and under UAVs.
That weight cap remains. Visual line of sight operations is still a requirement, unaided, as described previously, I think, in the NPRM, except for eyeglasses. Also, not over people, not directly participating in the operation. You know, David, this document that the FAA released, this 624-page document, which describes all of the aspects of the new Part 107, also spends a lot of time talking about the comments that were received for the NPRM on all of these issues and how the different individuals who responded and companies who responded view each of these aspects of the rule. And the FAA describes them and gives its logic for the selection that they made, that decision they made for what the final rule would be. And this topic of flying directly over people not directly involved generated pages and pages of discussion about that. But it is one of the waivable aspects of Part 107, as we'll see as we talk about some of these other aspects. But the baseline is not flying over people, flying in daylight only, except that they've expanded it a little bit from the NPRM. Instead of talking about sunrise to sunset, the rule allows twilight. It allows flying 30 minutes before sunrise and 30 minutes after sunset if the drone is equipped with lighting that's visible for at least 3 miles. So that's kind of a extension.
Pretty amazing lighting for 3 miles. That's like an airplane light.
Yes, yes. So I don't know if there'll be a lot of applications that will require that. But here again, this limitation on nighttime operations, that's something that can be waived if an application for a waiver is made to the FAA.
Speaking of large documents, I'll humor our audience. You know that this is not my full-time job, folks, but I was going to use the office printer, and I almost hit print on the PDF.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that I looked at the page count and went, oh, better not. So I almost had 698 pages or 28 pages printing out, hogging the office printer for a couple of hours, and I would have been in real trouble.
You would. Absolutely. Yeah, this is it's kind of tough to get through because it's so long, but it really is kind of interesting reading because you get a sense of how the FAA weighed the various options for each of these elements of the rule. And I think overall, I think they did a fantastic job, really. Not everybody's happy with everything, but I think most people
don't think everybody can be happy with everything.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So we were talking about daylight and civil twilight, right?
Right. And other operational limitations are yielding right of way to all other aircraft in the NAS. Transponders, TCAS, ADS-B, some of the commenters to the NPRM wanted to see those kinds of devices. The FAA decided no, that those would not be required. I think their logic being that there are other aspects of the rule that accomplish the same kinds of safety elements without requiring hardware like that. So that's kind of an interesting point. Let's see, what else? As with the NPRM, FPV does not satisfy the see and avoid requirement. We'll talk more about FPV coming up. You can have a speedy drone, though, David, if you like.
Well, maximum ground speed of 100 miles an hour. Yeah, I don't think I'm capable of flying an aircraft that fast, but there's a lot of radio-controlled aircraft that go that speed. Maximum altitude, of course, was 400 feet AGL. And minimal visibility, 3 miles, which there's a lot of fog and stuff. 3 miles is a pretty clear day, especially if you're flying line of sight. And, of course, operations in Class G airspace requires ATC permission. And this was surprising. No ATC permission required for Class B, C, D, and E airspace.
Yeah, that was an area where some of the folks who have looked and analyzed and commented on this were a little bit surprised, but that's what the FAA has gone with. There's a pre-flight inspection by the remote pilot in command. Now, that's a term, remote pilot in command. We'll talk about that in just a minute. External payload is allowed if it's securely attached and does not adversely affect the flight characteristics or the controllability of the aircraft.
Which brings me to the latest episode of Bones, the TNT television show.
Yeah.
They recovered a head from a crime scene with a UAV and flew it across town back to their lab. It was...
Oh, dear.
It was a very humorous view, but it was a very disruptive technology, as everybody reported in that they saw this head flying on attached to a hexacopter.
Hmm.
So, yes, you can have your external payload, but choose wisely.
Let's see. The package delivery is addressed. Actually, it's allowed for compensation, but only if the flight occurs wholly within the bounds of a state. And that's because otherwise it trips some interstate commerce regulations and statutes that make things very, very messy. But we'll talk about that, too, in a few minutes. David, let's talk about this remote pilot in command type of thing. You recall from the NPRM, the FAA was using this term, operator.
Yeah, and everybody really hated it.
They did, and they got a lot of comments about that. So now we have a term, the remote pilot in command. That terminology really does a lot of good things. It's more consistent with some international standards. Transport Canada, ICAO, and the UK use the term remote pilot, so it's consistent with that.
And the Air Force.
And the Air Force. Of course, we have pilot in command or PIC, which is a, sort of an established sort of position in the manned aviation world. And by switching the terminology to that and treating it as a pilot in command, really a lot of interesting things kind of fall in place when it comes to extending standards that have been long established for manned aviation and applying them to unmanned. So it works well. So this rule establishes that kind of a position. Now, they note that often that's the same person who's actually manipulating the controls. So it may be just one person, or you may have a separate person who is operating the controls, but you have to have a remote pilot in command.
You mean someone who's operating the camera versus someone operating the craft?
There could be those two people, but there has to be a pilot in command who can be one of those two people or can be a third person. But there has to be this remote pilot in command. They have to hold a remote pilot airman certificate with a small UAS rating, or the operator of the drone has to be under the supervision of a person who does hold a remote pilot certificate. Some of the people who commented on the NPRM apparently wanted a separate pilot in command position. Others did not. The FAA decided to go with it. This rule allows a small UAS to be operated by more than one person. So, for example, if it's a training scenario, the trainee and the pilot in command. The trainee may be actually operating the controls, but the remote pilot in command position has to exist and be right there so that if a situation occurred, some failure of equipment or some other situation that made the flight unsafe, that PIC could jump in and take control.
It makes sense. I mean, you're giving somebody the responsibility. You're deferring it. And in aviation, we have a pilot and a PIC, a pilot in command, who overall is in charge of the safety of the craft and all of the souls aboard. So the FAA is wisely doing the same thing for small UASs. I'm really good with that.
Yes.
You can point to one person and say, they're in charge.
That's right. Now, the obvious question becomes, so how do you become designated as a remote pilot in command? Well, to qualify for the certificate, you have to demonstrate aeronautical knowledge by either of two ways. You have to either pass an initial aeronautical knowledge test at an FAA-approved test center and then have recurrent testing every 2 years. Or if you hold a Part 61 pilot certificate, not a student pilot, however, and you complete a flight review with it, or you have completed a flight review within the previous 2 years, you can complete a small UAS online training course provided by the FAA. So either of those two ways, a knowledge test or a pilot certificate. But you also have to be vetted by the TSA. The FAA is going to pass your information on to the TSA to make sure that they don't have any concerns. And you have to be at least 16 years old. I think the NPRM had 17 maybe, but it's 16 in the rule.
16 years of age, you can solo. So they're being consistent.
So no medical certificate is required. There's no formal training required. There's not a training course that you have to do. You just have to pass that that knowledge test.
And we already know some people who, within the last day or so, have passed the knowledge test and are proudly showing their certificates.
Right.
Now, they are pilots to begin with, but they've gotten their test done, and they're rushing over to their local FISDOs to get it stamped onto their ticket. So let's talk about that, their knowledge test. So there's an initial aeronautical knowledge test, which is basic airmanship. Applicable regulations relating to small unmanned aircraft systems ratings, privilege limitations, and flight operations. So what does that mean? It means that you know how to operate the aircraft in its environment. The effects of weather on small unmanned aircraft performance. Now, this will be easier for the pilots because they're used to becoming weather junkies. I think they go hand in hand.
Sure.
I know that I'm probably a weather junkie because of my flight experience. This is important. Small unmanned aircraft loading. How do you balance your ship? You do that also for an aircraft. Weight and balance is really important when you're flying a small Cessna. You want to make sure everything's correct. So this aeronautical knowledge test is really mirroring what someone who's studying to be a pilot is. And, you know, in a neat sort of way, Max, people who get this certificate, probably it'll be real easy for them to get their private pilot's license. What do you think?
They will have progressed down that path, you know, to a certain extent. And actually, David, that raises an interesting point that came out in this document, which is that the FAA looked at some people who thought that you should have a pilot's license to fly a drone. Other people thought not. The FAA thought that it would be too burdensome to require a full pilot's license just to fly a drone. But also that if you have a pilot's license, while that would give you a lot of knowledge, airmanship and so forth that you would need, it doesn't give you everything you need to know about how to fly a drone. So this is something that kind of takes from both worlds and creates a knowledge test that's hopefully not too burdensome, but is relevant to flying unmanned aircraft.
And reasonable. I mean, the other thing the next things we'll talk about are CRM, otherwise known as crew resource management, emergency procedures, working with your partner. If you've got someone that's the observer flying the mission with you, and I know our friend Parker has emphasized this a lot, that you've got to work as a team. You are one group. It would be the same as someone flying an airplane with a pilot and a co-pilot. If you're flying an unmanned aircraft, you have the same sort of communications. If something's going wrong, you need to be able to communicate to your other person so they can take the correct actions. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
Determining the performance of small unmanned aircraft and maintenance and pre-flight inspection procedures.
Which that last one is added in part 107. That was not in the NPRM. And there were a few other aspects of the knowledge test that were in the NPRM but got dropped in the final rule. So that's the initial knowledge test. And there's also that recurrent knowledge test every 24 months.
Applicable regulations relating to small unmanned aircraft systems ratings, privileges, limitations, and flight operations. Things change, folks. So that's why you got to go back in 2 years.
Right.
And then the last three, emergency procedures, crew resource management, and maintenance and pre-flight inspection procedures. You know, for a while there, they were worried about the burdensome of having your drone have to be approved by a third-party inspection. It sounds like you need to just prove that you're actually doing the job and you've got proper procedures so you're not flying a broken aircraft.
Right. There are a few responsibilities that the remote pilot in command must adhere to. One is that if the FAA requests it, you have to make available the small UAS for inspection or testing. You also have to report to the FAA certain injuries or property damage that results from flights. And you also have to conduct a pre-flight inspection. That's that position. There's some comments in here about see and avoid and the visibility requirements. Some of the people who commented on the NPRM thought that visual line of sight, I mean, how reliable is that? I mean, how well can you see what's going on, see other aircraft and so forth? The FAA decided that between the visual line of sight requirement, which can be waived in certain situations, the requirement to yield the right of way, daylight flying, having minimum weather and visibility requirements, the FAA decided that given that this is for small UAS, that the risks involved are really covered by those kinds of requirements. And again, so that's why there's no requirement for ADS-B or other transponders, things like that.
Yeah, but if we ever start going beyond visual line of sight, that stuff's going to have to start coming into play, transponders. Yes. And we talked about before the show, you made the comment about it being an incremental step. This is a huge step forward, but it's a small step in the universe of what's to come. So this is another one of those. They were keeping it simple, keeping it smart, and keeping it small, I guess, and reasonable.
Absolutely. Another interesting aspect is the role of the visual observer. In the NPRM, this was kind of a key role, but that has changed now. And under the rule, the visual observer is an optional crew member. Now, the rule does provide a lot of information on how a visual observer should be used if you have one, but it's optional now.
Maybe in the meantime, we've proved the technology is sophisticated enough not to need that secondary. I don't know how often flyaways occur, and visual observers would be for a flyaway, So interesting that it's got minimized. This is a big one, and this was huge in the NPRM. FAA airworthiness certification is not required. Yay, FAA, because God, if we all had to go get our drones checked out and classified and certified, that would have been huge expense, huge time, and who's going to do it, where it's going to get done. And so kind of nice thing to have fall to the wayside.
Now, they do mention model aircraft because, of course, people are concerned about this. And the FAA tells us that Part 107 does not apply to model aircraft, that all of the criteria that are specified in Section 336 of Public Law 112-95, we've talked about those in the past. But the rule does codify the FAA's enforcement authority. So when the FAA says that if it is a model airplane, but you're operating in a way that endangers the safety of the national airspace system, then the FAA says we can come in and enforce any violations of that safety requirement. Or this concept is now or will be codified in this Part 107.
I don't know. It is.
To me, that makes sense.
I mean, somebody flies a radio-controlled drone loaded with explosives into a building, the FAA should be able to go bust their butt. And I didn't see any rebuttals from the AMA, so maybe they're accepting of this also.
By statute, by law, the FAA is supposed to leave model airplanes, hands off if they satisfy certain requirements. But the FAA is responsible for the safety in the national air system, so the national airspace system. So, whether it's a model airplane or a drone or I don't know what, somebody throws something up into the air far enough. I mean, it's a safety issue, and so they can enforce that. So I think that makes sense to me. An interesting aspect of the NPRM was that it raised the possibility of a micro UAS classification. And this is, or this was proposed to be for UAS that weigh less than 4.4 pounds, 2 kilograms. But the FAA decided that there really are too many issues, unresolved issues involved with a micro UAS concept. And they say that what we really need is a micro UAS framework, public comments, et cetera. So expect to see another NPRM to come that's just focused on this micro UAS concept.
So part 108, I guess.
or something.
So let's talk about what part 107 will not do. We've talked about the basics and the do's. It does not apply to transporting property for compensation. They could write out the word delivery. It would have been shorter than transporting property for compensation.
Right, right. The existing laws and statutory requirements say that if you transport property for compensation, that makes you an air carrier. And air carriers are subject to this whole other set of safety regulations, economic regulations, statutory requirements for liability insurance coverage, and you know, all of this stuff. Again, some of the commenters were for this, some were against it. One argument that was raised was that there's no difference, no safety difference, if you're being compensated for a package that you're flying around or not. Also, you know, what's the difference between carrying a small package on a drone and carrying a camera on a gimbal? I mean, both are part of the payload. So the FAA wanted to avoid triggering this air carrier kind of restriction. And so that's why we have, at this point in time, a limitation of package delivery for compensation within a state. You can't fly across state lines. They note that since this all applies to, or this all requires visual line of sight only, well, doesn't that kind of limit the degree to which you can engage in package delivery?
Well, not if you're following behind in a truck.
Well, except that. Right. they thought of that one, David. Yeah, no operations from a moving vehicle.
No. Well, the answer is yes. If we haven't moved beyond line of sight.
Yeah.
And again, that goes back to the conversation we had a few minutes ago, where when we open up beyond line of sight, we're going to open up a whole nother can of worms.
Yep.
So to be continued, I guess, on that. So
some other things that Part 107 do not apply to. One is international operations and foreign-owned aircraft. Part 107 only applies to operations within the U.S. Interestingly, public aircraft operations are exempt. This rule applies only to civil aircraft, so this doesn't touch the public applications, police, firefighting, things like that.
And model aircraft are exempt, and so are more balloons, kites, amateur rockets, unmanned free balloons. They're all excluded from coverage. So I can go fly my kite and be very happy.
That's right. But you can't tether your drone and fly that and claim it to be a balloon or a kite or something like that. The FAA explicitly addressed that. I know we've had some of our listeners ask if a tethered UAV is not subject to the rule. And the FAA says that a tethered drone does not fit the definition of a balloon, and it does not fit the definition of a kite. So that's clearly now not a way kind of around this.
They've worked really hard for the people who were trying to make exceptions for a lot of things over the last couple of years. They seem to be hitting those targets and saying, no, not going to work.
Yep.
Tethering was a big, I think we've talked about that quite a bit, about people thinking, well, it's tethered, so it's really not, no, it's a good thing.
Doesn't work. Let's see. We're almost out of time, but we're kind of through most of it. One question is, how does this all relate to people who have Section 333 exemptions, or people who have applications in for those exemptions? And what we understand is that current Section 333 exemption holders can continue to operate under those exemptions because they've been they've been given those exemptions. If you have an application in, well, I guess you have a choice. You can either continue with your exemption process, principally, I think, because what you are asking to do goes beyond what's allowable under the Part 107, or if what you're expecting to do can be done within the bounds of Part 107, then you can, you know, discontinue, disengage from the Section 333 exemption process and switch over to Part 107. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, kind of how that process is managed.
So overall, it seems a bit anticlimactic, doesn't it?
Maybe only because maybe we were expecting it to be worse and we were kind of gearing up for the disappointment. Instead, I think that, you know, many people are finding this to be a fairly reasonable set of rules. You have to recognize, like you said, David, that this is just one step in an ongoing process. The FAA, I think, is comfortable with that. And of course, now the next question is, so when does this all take effect? It's not in effect now. Well, for one thing, nothing happens until a rule is published in the Federal Register. So we're waiting for that. And probably the FAA is going to need some period of time to get ready for all of this. And the time frame that I hear thrown around is either 30 or 60 days, somewhere in that realm, before Part 107 is official.
But like I said, we already know of people who've already gotten their certificate. You know, the test was put up and they took it and they're all flashing them. I think we're going to probably reach out to some people and over the next couple of weeks and have them on and talk about their experiences. Mike, who was on a couple of episodes ago, quickly got his. Sarah also got hers. So it's, I don't know. I just, it's sort of all of the tension, all of the pressure of the NPRM, and it's out and now we've got something not to talk about, and they did a good job. I'm a little upset.
Well, there's still plenty to talk about. One thing we should mention, the webinar that's coming up, the Hogan Lovells webinar, it's Monday, June 27th, 2016. So if you're listening to this and want to get in on that webinar, act quickly.
And I believe you're going to take that, Max?
Yeah, I'm signed up for it. They're going to talk about differences between the final rule and what was proposed initially in the NPRM, timetable for implementation, as we were just talking, implications for Section 333 exemption and COA holders, the certification requirements, flights near and over people, visual line of sight requirements, the Part 107 exemption process, and some other things as well. So we'll have a link to the page where you can sign up for the webinar. But like we said, it's coming up on Monday, June 27th. So you'd want to jump on that really, really quickly. And we'll put a link to that, of course, in the show notes.
So I think...
do we want to mention this verdict in this court case really quickly, David?
Yeah, I guess we should. A little bit of news, which was, and this was from a website called Compton Takes Flight, where Arvel Chappell III challenged the constitutionality of charges brought against him by the city of Los Angeles for flying against the municipal anti-drone ordinance. Los Angeles put forth one of those, well, it's our city and we're going to do what I want and you're not allowed to fly your drones here. Well, he got arrested for it and challenged them. And believe it or not, the right verdict occurred. He got a not guilty verdict unanimously because the FAA and federal law preempt Los Angeles County law. And that's the right decision, I think, Max.
It certainly sounds like it. Maybe one of our attorneys who listens can let us know if this case stands on the proper grounds to be, you know, kind of valid precedent, or if there are some aspects of this from a legal standpoint that make it only applicable locally and, you know, in that in Los Angeles.
Are you calling it case law? You know, we weren't going to be lawyers on this show.
You can't avoid it, David.
We talked it down in D.C. when we were at the museum about the fact that, you know, I one of my taglines for this is, if I knew I was going to be a lawyer after 3 years of this, I would have never started it. But too late now.
Too late now. All right. Well, I think with that, we better bring this episode to a close. We certainly want to thank all of you for listening to episode 151 of the UAV Digest. If you've got some thoughts on the part 107 rules, we, of course, invite you to send those to us. You can find us at the UAVDigest.com. Of course, we'll have show notes at the UAVDigest.com/151.
And we really would love for you to join the conversation and become part of our listener team, our Slack listener team. And that's you can find that on our website, UAVDigest.com/team. We've got a bunch of people who have been talking about the new notice and how it's affecting them. So definitely join the team. If not, you can always find us on Twitter at UAV Digest or on Facebook at facebook.com/theUAVDigest. And like Max said, we want to hear from you, and you can send us feedback. And our email address is feedback@theUAVDigest.com. Likewise, if you want to help us, you can do it multiple ways. You can do it by leaving a review on iTunes, saying how wonderful we are, or Stitcher, or Google Play. Likewise, you could always get some swag. We have our Cafe Press store, which is cafepress.com/theUAVDigest, and our Patreon account, which is patreon.com/theUAVDigest. And I would like to thank our listeners, because their patron accounts were able for me to pay for my hotel room down in D.C. So that we could bring you coverage. And we, Max and I, both really appreciate our patrons and our sponsors. We're looking forward to some events coming up, and we're working on maybe getting some swag that we can send out, like pins, like our Airplane Geeks pins. So we do appreciate it. The money goes to good use, and we really appreciate it. But most of all, everybody who listens to the show, we really appreciate you. And we don't tell you that enough, but know that Max and I value all of our interactions, either via email or, like happened at Udvar-Hazy, interactions face-to-face. So thanks to our listeners. So I guess with that schmaltzy ending, I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.